Hi, I'm Pat Kelly.
And I'm Peter Oldring, and we're the hosts of This Is That.
Are you kidding?
For over a decade, we were radio's go-to source for completely fabricated news.
You must be joking me.
And now, we're back in podcast form.
We've selected some of our favorite stories from over the years and put them in one convenient location.
Sugar in the tap water.
Bilingual dog park. Charging to see wildlife.
This Is That, coming soon on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Q. You might have heard the news that Steve Albini has died. He was 61. He had a heart attack while he was at his recording studio. I got the chance to talk with him last fall when Nirvana's In Utero was turning 30. So in honor of Steve and in remembrance of Steve, we wanted to play that conversation for you again. Steve was a legendary musician, a producer, a recording engineer, he actually preferred to be called. He worked with, a million bands. He worked with Pixies and PJ Harvey, really helped to define their sound. He was also a bit of an iconoclast. He could be a bit of a curmudgeon in his early years. He talks about himself as a really challenging producer to work with or be around. But in recent years, gave a mea culpa about his privileged position in life and his former behavior. Here's a tweet after the news of Steve Albini's passing went around from the Canadian band Fucked Up that I thought really summarized it well. R.I.P. Steve Albini, you hated our band and made fun of us while we were recording at your studio, but you stood for something honest and fair in music and tried to make it a better place in everything you did, and there will never be another one like you. Like I mentioned, Steve Albini is best known for working on one of the most defining records of the 90s, maybe kind of ever, Nirvana's In Utero. Hey, wait! That is Nirvana and Heart-Shaped Box off their final studio album, In Utero, released back in 1993. I mean, this was the album that Nirvana made after Nevermind, which took them from being a garage band in Seattle to becoming one of the biggest bands, if not the biggest band in the entire world. And the pressure was on for their new record, and the record label had all kinds of expectations, and things were only supposed to get bigger and bigger and bigger. But Kurt Cobain wanted to go the other way. He wanted to make a record that sounded like a band in a room playing together, far away from what others expected of Nirvana. So Kurt sought out the guy to record the album who had made some of his favorite music with bands like the Pixies, you know, bands in a room with mics on. And that guy was Steve Albini. And he and the band camped out and produced a record when they were at the most popular they ever were. They made a record that scared the record label, sold millions of copies, and is regarded as one of the greatest of all time. We were so sad to hear of the loss of Steve Albini. We really loved our conversation with him, our love to his family and friends, and we thought we should re-air this conversation. Here's Steve Albini. Steve, how are you?
Pretty good today, yeah.
I'm glad. Congratulations on 30 years.
Yeah, you know, the remarkable thing about it is that I didn't have to do anything for it to get to 30 years. I just basically just carried on and it happened, you know, unbidden.
Yeah, you deserve none of the acclaim for the 30 years.
Yeah, over the years, I feel like I have gotten a lot of undue attention for the sake of records that I worked on that in my lights anyway would have been remarkable records, regardless of who was in the chair making them. And I think this is a pretty good example. Like the record was recorded in a conventional fashion and in very Spartan arrangements. And I think, you know, a monkey of a certain intellectual capacity could have been trained to make that record and it would have been just as good, in my opinion. But
how did you get involved in the first place?
There had been rumors kind of floating around in the year or so prior to my being asked to work on that record that Nirvana were interested in working with me specifically as a departure from the sort of career arc that was expected of them, which was to, having made a huge smash hit record, to just go back into the studio with the same or a similar circumstance and make another smash hit record. And they wanted to thwart that by making a record in the style that they were accustomed to prior to their massive success. That is just write the songs, arrange them, rehearse them, go into the studio, knock them out, and call it done. The main concern is just, I mean, I knew that they were capable of making a good record on their own terms. They had done it before, and they, you know, they were seasoned, and they were, you know, they're a remarkable band in many ways. But the main thing would be just what they would have to deal with, sort of, I guess the term would be politically, within their record label and management hierarchy, for not doing things in the way that they were being asked to. The way that what they were being asked to do was to make another one of the same record that they had just previously made that was hugely successful. And they didn't want to make the same record again. They wanted to make a different record. And, you know, we talked about the idea that everyone involved that was sort of had sort of attached themselves to the band, but not the members of the band, but all the people around them whose livelihoods and status kind of depended on the success of this record. All of those people would have self-interest, and they would see that as legitimate purchase for them to be critical of all of their decisions, and to, you know, to try to convince them to do it in a way that they were comfortable with rather than in the way that they wanted to do it.
Yes, I'm leaving. Now that you're leaving, soon as you can pay.
Yes, I'm relaxing. Knowing what I know of you is that, and I don't really know if I have the word for it, but like very everyday, you know, someone asks you to do a record, you do a record with them, you record them, you make sure they're doing the kind of the best performances they can, and you do, you know, countless records a year. But is there a part of you that when you finally say yes to this and the band agrees to work with you, is there any part of you at all that's kind of like, oh my God, I'm making the Nirvana Nevermind follow up record? I'm part of that thing.
No, I mean, honestly, nobody in the room had any thoughts about that. And in terms of like the expectations associated with the record, like literally from the first song that they ran through, I knew it was going to be a good record, and we didn't have anything to worry about. It could have turned into some kind of a catastrophe. Like a lot of things could have gone wrong, and you know, everybody was kind of prepared for things to get derailed in one way or another. But because those kind of lightning strike events happen and randomly bands have to suffer them, but it wasn't tense, it wasn't self-conscious, everything about it seemed very natural and very normal. It was like very much at that point I was doing on the order of 100 albums a year with, you know, very short stints in the studio, very small budgets, and it felt very much like another one of those records that I had been making. You know, just the band had their material together. They played really well. They communicated well within the band, and they were holding themselves. They had held themselves to a high standard, and they delivered. I was really impressed with the band, with the way they played, and how together everything was when we got to the studio. And once they started playing, nobody had any second thoughts, honestly.
Can you tell that story that I've heard about these sessions that I really, really like, but I'd like to hear it from you, is that the one consideration, or one of the considerations with working with a band as big as Nirvana at that point, was that you had to give a fake name to the studio. Can you tell that story?
When you're dealing with somebody who's incredibly famous, you want to do what you can to preserve their privacy so that they get to have a normal experience and not have to like fight off the paparazzi or, you know, Rolling Stone reporters or whatever. So we chose a studio that was very nice studio, acoustically very nice, you know, good equipment. I'd had good results there. I'd done a few records there already. I did the Wedding Present and a PJ Harvey record and a couple of other records that had gone well there. And it was about 50 miles outside of Minneapolis, which already provided some layer of anonymity and a buffer between them and potential problems, just that it wasn't in the middle of a big metropolis where people would see them, you know, waiting for the bus or whatever. And it was a residential studio, meaning that everyone could stay inside the studio. So there wouldn't be, you know, taxis to and from a hotel or whatever, where word could get out and people would, you know, eventually the word could get out that something was happening regarding this very famous band. And one of the ways that I tried to preserve their privacy was by, when I booked the studio, I booked it as a session of mine, and we used a fake band name to hold the booking. And the fake band name was the Simon Ritchie Band, Simon Ritchie being Sid Vicious's birth name. When the guy that owned the studio, when I was doing the booking, he's Simon Ritchie Band. And I said, yeah, it's kind of a bluegrass band. Like, I just sort of deflected, and I couldn't, that was poorly considered. Honestly, I hadn't thought that through, because they were contacted by a freight company a couple of days before the session saying, yeah, we have a semi truck with all the equipment for the session, for the Simon Ritchie Band. And, you know, a bluegrass band doesn't need a semi-truck full of equipment. So when they met the truck and started unloading all the flight cases that had Nirvana screen printed on them, then they knew, they knew what was up. But mercifully, that was literally the day before everyone arrived, and there was no time for anything to leak out. And we were done and out of there within 2 weeks, so there wasn't really time for anything, you know, for word to get out and or for anything treacherous to transpire. I'm not like them, back in town. The sun is gone, I have a light. The day is done, and I'm having fun. I think I'm dumb, maybe just happy.
How was Kurt in the studio? What do you remember about Kurt in the studio?
Extremely focused. He was kind of reserved around me at a minimum, like he might have been. And you get the impression that some of that is slightly defensive from, you know, and he may have learned that fairly recently, like having only recently become extremely famous. I never pressed him for any intimacy. You know, I made it clear that I worked for him and that I was there to do a job. And I wasn't one of the countless people who were trying to insinuate themselves into his life in order to be, you know, either vicariously or vampirically sort of part of the process. I didn't want him to have any reservations about me in that regard. So I made it clear that I was working for him. The degree of preparedness was really impressive to me. Like, they had done some demo recordings of the songs, and they had rehearsed them quite a bit, but he had also had sort of second level production ideas in mind for each of the songs, like you know, a complimentary guitar part or a moment of special effect in the vocal, or you know, something. And then the thing that impressed me the most was when the time came for him to do the final vocals for the album. We had several days left in the session, and plenty of time for him to take a leisurely pace in the recording the vocals. But he basically just started at the beginning and sang the whole album. Like, it was one fairly long session, I want to say 8 or 10 hours, and he sang basically the entire album. He may have redone a song or two the following day, but he essentially sang the whole record in one go. Hey, wait.
That's wild to me because it's a relatively, I don't want to say it's screamy, like it's not like a Minor Threat record or anything like that, but it's like a relatively screamy, raspy record. I mean, yeah, that's a long run.
Yeah, but also like I think it's apparent that people whose singing style has that aspect, they get good at it over time.
Fair enough.
And it's less stressful for someone who is trained or has trained themselves to be, you know, to have a very harsh vocal tone. It's less stressful on them than it would be on you or me doing it cold, you know. So I think that's part of it. He knew what he was capable of, and he knew how to go about it in a way that wouldn't be destructive.
You're in the middle of my conversation with the late music producer Steve Albini, recording engineer of Nirvana's In Utero. We learned on Wednesday that Steve died of a heart attack, so we wanted to bring back this conversation. In Utero is regarded as a masterpiece in 2023. But back in 1993, as you're about to hear, when they first listened to the completed record, Nirvana's record label hated it. So I asked Steve Albini what that was like for him to hear. That's where we pick up our conversation.
I remember an immense feeling of satisfaction on the part of the band when we were listening to the playback of the masters after we'd finished everything. Just everybody was just grinning ear to ear, listening to song after song where they really felt like they'd knocked it out of the park. And, then everybody decamped and went home, and Kurt called me and he said, yeah, you were right. Everybody hates the record and they want us to redo it. And that was sobering, that, you know, people present it, you know, I can understand people like in their minds, like imagining some kind of a fiasco of a, you know, some kind of an abrasive, noisy, unlistenable trash record, you know, imagining that might be what comes back, you know, but what they were delivered is what you hear when you play the record. And it's clearly done artfully. It's clearly done with intent. It might be, you know, a couple of clicks more aggressive in spots and a couple of clicks more obtuse in spots than the typical top 40 record of the day. But it's, you know, it's not a piece of shit is what I'm getting at, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, and it's not like, it's not something that's really hard to listen to unless you're into hardcore or unless you're into, you know.
So one thing that's kind of odd, though, it's like when I listen to that record now with, you know, all of the myriad trends and sort of desensitizing effects that have happened in the interim, all the many more crazy, harsh and abrasive styles of music that have come in the interim. When you listen to it now, it's like I'm baffled, like what the gripe was. It sounds like a normal record to me, you know. But if you just even, you know, on YouTube, whatever, like bounce around on some other records that were released in the early 90s and listen to a few of their contemporary major label cohort, it's pretty apparent how awful a lot of that music was and how dull and bland a lot of that music was, and how, like, I can understand if you were acclimatized to that kind of music, hearing something that to my mind was fairly indicative of their, you know, their upbringing in the post-punk underground, like a record that was in keeping with all of their peers, like it, you know, the bands that they admired and that they emulated their entire existence, the Melvins and the Jesus Lizard and even bands like the Pixies, like it's not that different from the bands that they were contemporaneous with. What's different about it is the context of them being the biggest band in the world.
Yeah.
And the biggest band in the world, you know, previously that would be, you know, much more pedestrian music. So Kurt called me and he said, yeah, everyone hates it. They want us to redo it. And on, you know, on second thought, like there are a couple of things that we'd like to do differently as well. And so we're thinking about trying to remix some stuff. And do you want to do it? And so, and I said, well, let me listen. I had a copy of the master at my house. I said, well, let me listen to my copy. And if I feel like I can do any better anywhere, then I'm, you know, I'm happy to be involved. You know, you guys hired me. I work for you. I'll do what you want. But if I feel like it's a losing effort, I don't want to waste your time. I don't want to waste the energy. And I also don't want you to be in a position where you are seen as having failed at something by dint of us trying to do, you know, alternate versions and then still not being satisfied. Right. So I listened to the entire album and I had the same exact feeling as I did when we did the first playback, that they really wrung the sponge. Like they got, you know, like it was a great record and they had nothing to be ashamed of. And I didn't feel like I could, on an engineering level, like I didn't feel like there was anything that I could do better to represent those masters. And so I called Kurt back and I said, yeah, I don't think I can do any better than this. This is about as good as you're going to get out of me. But, you know, if you want to fiddle around with it, it's your record. And if you want to fiddle around with it, you know, you have my blessing. It's your record. You should do what you like. But I don't think I can do anything more. In the end, they did end up, like, I think they added some backing vocals to a song and they did remix a couple of songs. That aspect of it has been kind of portrayed as like the record label triumphing over them and forcing a concession out of them. And speaking of the sort of lore and myth versus reality, that's absolutely not what happened. Like, it's totally normal for a band to have some reservations about their record after they finished it and to second guess themselves and want to try some alternate versions. That's a totally normal thing and much less famous and notorious people than Nirvana have done that, you know, many times. And so the fact that they remixed a couple of songs and that those ended up being the singles, you shouldn't read too much into that. Like, it's very easy for that to become a kind of a narrative where the record label like won in the end and got forced a concession out of the band. And that's absolutely not what happened. I saw that as Nirvana sort of managing the situation to the extent they could and maintaining their control over their own record.
Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
We're in the middle of my conversation with the legendary producer and recording engineer Steve Albini. Steve Albini has died of a heart attack. He was 61. I got the chance to talk to Steve when the most probably famous album he ever produced, Nirvana's In Utero, turned 30 last fall. And aside from his pretty incredible technical abilities, Steve is also, as you can hear, one of the most thoughtful folks in the music industry. And that's where this conversation goes now. He gets a little spiritual on what really matters in music, how mistakes and imperfection are actually important, and why myth-making in music actually makes things less interesting. Let me tell you this, because I don't know if I'm ever going to get a chance to talk to you again. So I'll tell you what changed my mind on this. I was a big believer in the myth. I was a big believer. I mean, you know, I played in toured in a folk band and I do this job, but like I was a big believer in the myth and I collected the myth and I loved the myth. And then when I was a big believer in the myth around Bob Dylan, like, oh, that, you know, this guy who represented, you know, and was sort of godlike to me, you know, that, you know, he had these incredible powers and changed his name and blah, 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 blah. And then I remember I went to see him in my hometown in St. John's and I went up to the front and he was wearing like sweatpants on stage. And I had this moment. I had this moment of like, so two things happened. One, I went, "Oh, he's just a dude. That's just a guy. That's not a special person. That's just a guy." And I think his music is even more meaningful to me now without the myth, because it came from just a guy.
there's a kind of a projection where people think like, oh, I'm incapable of that. So people are incapable of that. So it must be something other than just somebody singing a song. There must be more to it than that, you know. And these myths provide some kind of palliative care for someone who doesn't want to recognize that some people are just really good at things, and that somebody being really good at something means that they can go into the studio and a half an hour later come out with something that'll break your heart, you know. It pains people to think that it's normal everyday stuff being an artist or a musician. Like, so they like these tales of wildness and abandon and eccentricity because it provides a like justification for them not aspiring to something, or justification for them not trying something. It's like, oh, you need to be a special driven freak to do those kinds of things. When in reality, you can be, you know, a suburban dad and still do incredible art if what you're doing is trying to express yourself rather than trying to fit a paradigm, you know?
So how did you get there on that?
Just seeing it happen in front of me every day. Like, being a part of the punk scene was really transformative for me. Like, I came to Chicago in 1980 to go to college, but I immediately just was embedded in the music scene and surrounded by the craziest freaks and the most insane, energetic, intelligent people. And just seeing what normal, regular people that you would ride the bus with were capable of when they had a mind to do it with the barest of tools, like just the bare essentials of anything. And that really changed my perception of everything. Like, you didn't need a license. You didn't need to be trained in anything. All you needed to do was just dive in and get started. And, you know, maybe you're going to make a sloppy mess of it in the beginning, but you'll find your sea legs and you'll find your own style. And if you pursue it and if you're doing it diligently, what you're trying to do is express yourself in a way that's unique to you. And I promise you, every single person has a voice. Every single person can do it.
Now I understand your recording, because there's a lot made of the fact that you are a recording engineer and not a producer. There's a lot made of the fact that you don't take points off the records. There's a lot made of the thing that you said to me off the top, that like, hey, you know, I just had to press the record button and that band was going to make what they made. But I think I understand it now a little bit better, because if the band themselves has an authentic, maybe not authentic, what is, I don't even know what authenticity is. If the band itself has something coming out of them that feels appropriate and good and real, you know that that's all you got to get. You know that you don't got to get in the way of it.
So if you just think about your own experience as a listener, like the records that you respond to, like the records that mean the most to you, the things that you hear and they're gripping, like what you're reacting to is an effort at communion. Like the person on the other side of the microphone has something on their mind, and they want you to understand their enthusiasm or their mania or their interest or their horror or whatever it is. They want you to understand their idea. And the whole effort, everything about making a record, is about that notion of communication or communion between the listener and the person performing. The creative impulse is that. I'm convinced that the creative impulse is second maybe to the mating instinct or hunger or one of those. And it is innate in everyone. And what you're reacting to is something that is uniquely the product of that one person's mind or that one collective's mind. Like that group does a thing and you respond to it because it's uniquely theirs and you get it. Now you understand something more about them, right? But if you ask the authorities about the arts, you know, how do you go about doing this? They will give you these procedural steps that you can use to become competent at execution of a painting or a written score or a soliloquy or something. They will give you tools that allow that actually are basically only concerned with competence. And I submit that the thing that makes music, that makes art, that makes any creative enterprise interesting is unrelated to its competence. I remember hearing a thing, I don't even remember where it was, but it was some engineer, this is an example of engineering hubris, like some engineer took an Ella Fitzgerald performance and auto-tuned it, you know? And it was a demonstration.
I've always felt Ella Fitzgerald records needed auto-tune. That's always been my feeling, yeah.
Well, exactly. That's the point. Like, what you like about music is unrelated to its technical competence. Like, I've never once in my life, not once, not one time ever, have I ever sat engrossed in a record and then thought to myself, I would have liked it, except they sped up a little bit there. I could tell that they sped up a little bit going into that chorus, and that's just not going to fly with Uncle Steve. You know, I want my music listening to be linear. You know, I've just never thought that way ever. I just don't think those things matter to people. But those are some of one of the small number of things that can be controlled in the studio environment. Like, you can put a metronome up and make certain that every take comes out precisely the same mathematical tempo. That checks a box on a list of attributes of competence or something, but it has absolutely no relationship to whether or not the music that comes out is good, right? I can't remember who it was, but someone at the studio made a very pithy comment that all the records in the dime bin at the record store, they don't have a mistake on them anywhere. Like, they're all perfect, you know. Meanwhile, you know, you listen to a Led Zeppelin song where you can hear like the clumsy edit or the bad punch in or the print through echo, or like you can hear all these technical flaws that just they don't matter. They don't have any bearing whatsoever on whether or not something is good. Or, you know, like, you listen to some of those surf records, like, and, you know, those are, you know, intricate, tricky guitar runs that they had to play. And they're, you know, high tempos, and the tempos go all over the map. You know, they speed up like mad, and, you know, there's dead notes everywhere in every one of those guitar solos. It's like, it just doesn't matter. Nobody cares.
I love that. Because you're right. My favorite records are, and I'm a bluegrass guy, speaking of, not even a fake band bluegrass guy. But I remember listening to the Stanley Brothers, and I remember them being a little bit out of tune.
Sure.
And just thinking it was the greatest thing I'd ever heard in my entire life.
When it gets sour and then solves itself, that's like that's, you know, you can live in that. That's incredible. I don't like dropping names. It makes it seem like I'm appealing to authority. But I did a record with Jimmy Page one time, Jimmy Page and Robert Plant. And I had an experience with him that I thought was pretty enlightening. He was known as an exceptional studio guitarist. Like, he made his living playing sessions, and, you know, he had to sight read things, complex pieces of music, play them perfectly the first time through, or he'd be fired, right? So from a technical standpoint, he's an exceptional musician by anybody's measure, right? We were working on this song, and he had done, in the live take of the song with the band, he had done a guitar solo that was, you know, in the solo section of the song, he'd played a solo live on the floor. There were a couple of little things in the solo that he wanted to correct. And while we were playing through it, he was listening for these things that he wanted to correct. Like, there was a movement that was a little slow in one spot. He wanted it to be of a particular rhythm. There was another spot in this, while we were sitting there listening, looking for things to repair. There was one section of the solo where he played a little figure, a little three-note figure, diddle-a-dum, 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 right? And it was a repeated three-note figure. And one of the notes in one of the iterations of the figure was thumbed. So it was like diddle-a-dum, diddle-a-dum, right? Like he blew one of the notes, right? So I pointed that out, that I noticed that, like, do you want to, while we're fixing stuff, do you want to fix that one little clam there? And he said, no, they'll get the idea.
Yeah.
And I thought, what an absolutely perfect summation of, you know, 40 years as a professional musician and as a genius, like a genuine genius who changed music. Like, what an encapsulation of his entire career. They'll get the idea. Like, all he really wants, he has these ideas. He just wants you to get the idea. Once you got it, then that's good. And that moment has stayed with me. I drop that anecdote almost whenever I have the opportunity, just because, like, it would have been a trivial thing for him to fix that diddly-dum, 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 right? And afterwards, people still would have gotten the idea. But he wasn't concerned about the cosmetic perfection of it. What he wanted was to have played this thing extemporaneously and have it come off and let people get it. And so I think that attitude is, especially in the contemporary production environment where there are such powerful corrective tools available in digital systems, it's almost like you wouldn't be allowed to hear something like that in a contemporary record, because it would be considered poor manners to let a thumbed note like that slide as an engineer. Like, when it's just so easy, just drag and drop, you know, I could just, let me just straighten it out a little bit. Not perfect. I just want to straighten it out a little bit. Like, you know, like that impulse is just so natural now in the contemporary production aesthetic, that I feel like it goes against the core project of playing music for other people.
Steve, I could talk to you for a million years about all this. And thanks for making the time to talk to us a little bit In Utero and talk a little bit about perfection and in music and all that. Love it to get a chance to talk to you.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
From Nirvana and Steve Albini's 1993 masterpiece In Utero, that is Nirvana and All Apologies. Though I know Steve would hate if I said it was his album, because he just thought, hey, I turned the mics on, the band does the rest of it. That album's producer and recording engineer, Steve Albini, has died. He was 61. Our love and condolences to all his family and friends and the musicians who worked with him.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.